I don't extend myself too much on my opening argument and
whatever you have left, then okay.
Answering your expected pointed questions.
Good. Okay, go ahead, please.
Thank you. So, good morning to the panel. I do appreciate your time and review of this matter. I'm Michael Checky, and on behalf of the appellant, the debtor, and the plaintiff in the adversary matter, Christian Gavois. So I'd like to start with the standard of review and actually an apology to the panel and to counsel. I did make a major error in briefing on the first issue, on the stay relief issue. It should be a de novo standard of review, not clear error, and that's set forth in the In Re Partida case, Ninth Circuit, 2017, 862, Fed Third, 809, at page 912.
Well, let me stop you for a sec right there. The argument would be that those are issues that are purely statutory interpretation, in your mind?
Yes.
Well, wouldn't it matter, for example, against whom an action were commenced? I mean, that's a factual question, right? So, for example, the unlawful detainer here was commenced against the party ostensibly, the other party of the lease, and not Mr. Gavois, right? Isn't that a factual question?
Yes.
Okay, so that's clear error, right?
It's mixed. It's a mixed
Okay, but at least part of this is going to be clear error. You'd agree, right?
Fair enough. Okay. And I do want to talk about those facts.
Sure.
I think it's a fact, definitely a fact-sensitive issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so... For the same proposition, there in that case, Espinosa and Adler v. Leishen is cited, Ninth Circuit, 2002, 309, Fed Third, 1210. And so I think, as to both issues on appeal, the stay violation and the recovery of estate property issue, the panel should look at least in part with fresh eyes as to the de novo standard. And so let's get into the facts, and I want to be honest. I think there's an easy issue for appellant on the facts, and then there's a more difficult one. The easier one is, and this deals with what is property of the estate, because we have to start there. The easier factual issue is, was the Minter Air lease a contract in debtor's personal name, or a DBA, which would be property of the estate. The lease was identified in the originally filed Schedule G of debtor's bankruptcy schedules.
Which your counterparty had no notice of, right? Until significantly later in the case.
That's correct.
Okay.
Because Mr. Gavois was current on his lease obligation with the appellee as of the petition date.
We'll get into all the series of amendments at some point, but certainly for a very long time, the airport authority had no idea there was a bankruptcy involved.
Correct. Right? They were not listed as a creditor.
Okay.
Correct. It wasn't, as far as I know, until I actually wrote a letter as debtor's counsel to
I think you're right.
to Mr. Stroud's law firm,
I think you're right.
notifying them. So the lease was signed by debtor in his personal name. And the only mention of a business name was at the top of the very brief lease.
Where did it identify says, the parties?
It said the lessee was SRT Helicopter.
That's kind of important, isn't it?
Very important.
Okay.
But it's lacking the LLC or Inc. or anything thereafter. And I think if you look at the trial testimony, you've got a transcript of Jonathan Hudson, who's the sole witness for the appellee. He said he thought he was dealing with the LLC, SLT Helicopters LLC, because of a business card given to him by Mr. Gavois. He looked at the business card. It had a website on it. He reviewed the website. At the bottom of the website, it had the name SRT Helicopter LLC. Okay, so fine. So if we believe that, then why isn't that name on the lease?
Well, two-thirds of it is. I mean, SRT Helicopters is there.
Right, SLT Helicopter singular. The actual LLC name is SRT Helicopters Kana LLC. And so,
is it your position that because of what you think of as an ambiguity, there was some obligation by the airport authority to do some due diligence and figure out who SRT was?
Is that your question? Absolutely. And I examined Mr. Hudson at trial on that issue. Didn't ask for tax returns, didn't do a Dun & Bradstreet check,
When entering the lease, you're supposed to ask for tax returns.
Not necessarily, but...
The lease was not the most commercially sophisticated that I've ever seen. So that seems like some serious Monday morning quarterbacking. Well, why is that relevant, the standard, in trying to assess who the parties are?
Because the appellee is trying to say that it did not violate the stay because the non-debtor SLT Helicopters LLC was the one sued.
But I guess my problem is that you are suggesting what they should have done where there's testimony what they did do. And it doesn't seem like you disagree with that. It's not challenging what they did, which was check the card, back it up to the website, find the LLC. Why wasn't that enough?
But it could have been enough.
If it could have been enough, why is that error?
Because if that's the only piece of evidence that Mr. Hudson, on behalf of the Minter heir, looked at before he drafted the lease, then he should have put that name at the top, and he should have had Mr.
Doesn't that work both ways, though? That your client really could have said his name as the party entering it, his name as the signatory DBA, or whatever. It works both ways. Your client could have been a lot more specific and clear if he's really saying now that he was the entity to whom the lease was being made.
Well, I think SRT Helicopter on its face looks like a DBA. A DBA is...
SRT Helicopter looks like SRT Helicopter.
Can I go back to something kind of fundamental? I mean, we begin with the question of against whom was an action taken. It was taken against the LLC, right?
Well, if you look at the excerpt of record 3, you see that the lease termination notice started out in the name of Chris Gadbois. It was directed to Chris Gadbois, and then underneath it said SRT Helicopter, consistent with the lease. Mm-hmm. And then when they actually file one or two lawsuits,
they sued
SRT Helicopters LLC.
Yeah, okay. So the question really is there some basis on which the airport knew or was supposed to know or was obligated to know that this really wasn't a lease with SRT Helicopter LLC? That's the question, right?
That's part of the question, but I think you need to look at the timing of all of this. And was it just laziness on behalf of Minter Air actually filing a relief from stay action and getting permission of the court, which they could have done and they didn't do?
Well, if I take your first point that this is doctrinal and it's a legal issue, I mean, the legal issue is what's the obligation of somebody who apparently has a contract, at least theoretically, with an LLC. Now, you may say that was more ambiguous than maybe Judge Zerzlow thought it was. But the question is, what's the obligation of the person before they take a legal action? And if the question is you got to do some due diligence at some point, I mean, does this get into whether there was really an understanding by the other party that they were violating the stay, or is it strict liability? Is it just, well, you know, if you're right that this is Gadbois, no matter what they did, the airport's going to be liable?
I don't think it was a knowing violation until they knew. But once they knew was a bankruptcy, then it be, and there...
But whether there was a bankruptcy doesn't change who the lessee is. Right?
Correct.
Okay. That's what I'm trying to get at here. What's the duty you want to put on the lessor here?
Is to sue in the name of the party to the lease, which was SRT Helicopter and Chris Gadbois. And they switched it. You can see
but
that
they didn't sue. But they didn't sue Gadbois, right? So they at least facially didn't violate the lease, the automatic stay in that sense.
Correct.
Okay.
But then we look at the upshot, what was the result of them getting the default judgments during the pendency of the Chapter 13 was to lock out Mr. Gabbaugh from his business and to keep his
as somebody who was an employee of the business from their perspective. So,
well, I think the records and files at the very least would be property of the estate. If we look at California Civil Code Section 1993.03 sub A, it states in pertinent part, if property remains on the premises after a tenancy is terminated and the premises have been vacated by the tenant, the landlord shall give written notice to the tenant and to any other person the landlord reasonably believes to be the owner of the property if the property consists of records.
But is that
as files?
Is that a state violation or is that just a California statute that says what you're supposed to do when you lock somebody out?
I think we need to look at California law to see. The last part I was going to read, Justice Lafferty, was that the tenant shall be presumed to be the owner of the records for the purposes of this chapter, and that's what Mr. Gabbaugh asserts, is that this is his property, not the LLC's property. The very least, the files that were in there and that are still there's still a lot of personal property still being held at the Minter Air facility.
Isn't the question of who was the lessee under this lease a question of fact?
Yes, that is a factual question.
Okay, and Judge Zerzlow resolved that against your client, right?
Yes.
If that's
on the basis that he was not credible, and I think the panel should look at what was admitted into evidence, which was one of his prior totally unrelated misdemeanor criminal conviction. And
right. Well, let me stop. And
that was a basis, one of the bases,
right,
that he found it not to be credible.
But if we find that factual finding is not clearly erroneous, what's left of your case?
I think that the judge didn't analyze the fact that the plan was confirmed, the fact that under the code of 1325A7, that confirmation of a plan includes a finding of the court that the action of filing the petition was in good faith. And this is 100%.
How does that bear on the question of who's the lessee under this lease?
It bears on the issue of that Mr. Gabbaugh was not credible.
But you know, just not to get too deeply into the weeds here, there been a disclosure at the time of plan confirmation that there are these other assets and these other relationships. The planning proposal wouldn't have been confirmed. Right? I mean, you would have had to take account of some other liabilities and some other issues, and, you know, the trustee would have had some questions. I don't see how you can rely on confirmation at all, given the complete lack of candor, even if you're right about what the assets were.
Well, this is a post-petition default.
That's not the question. The question is, there would have been other questions had your client disclosed all these other relationships. There's no guarantee. In fact, I would bet a fair amount of money that plan wouldn't have been confirmed in the form it was.
Because the lease, the equipment, the records, those are, under your theory, were all his property,
yeah,
right? Personal property. None of that was disclosed in the bankruptcy case prior to plan confirmation.
That's true. And I admit that is troublesome that the amendment was not filed until sometime later.
So you're relying on a plan confirmation order that's premised on a non-disclosure.
Well, but you have to look at the terms of the plan. The terms of the plan say that he's paying 100 cents on the dollar to all allowed claims. If this is a post-petition default, he's not getting a discharge of that debt. It's post-petition. And it's not mentioned they're not listed as a creditor in the plan either, so they're not going to get a discharge of that. He's not going to get a discharge of that debt.
Lease is rejected then, right? I mean, The non-disclosure has effects that go way beyond just plan confirmation.
If the lease is rejected, which it probably was, he didn't assume it, that doesn't abrogate the stay. The stay is still there.
Well, there's a feasibility issue that never got adjudicated either because of this other obligation. You're out of your time.
Yeah, you predicted correctly. You'd use up your time in your opening argument. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time.
Okay. Mr. Stroud, let's see. Good morning.
Good morning. All right. I would like to make just a few points this morning, and then I would like to answer any questions you have for me. The first thing I would like to say is this isn't the first time I've heard this argument that the district could have and should have filed a relief from stay action. The difficulty with that theory is that, as we stipulated in the statement of facts at trial, the district had no notice of this bankruptcy action until long after the unlawful detainer proceedings were concluded, when I received a letter from Mr. Chechia. Now, the due diligence point that has come up, both with regard to the bankruptcy and with regard to who the lessee is alleged to have been, this is a requirement I can find nowhere in the law. I don't think it exists. I do think that my client did engage in some amount of appropriate diligence. They did look up the website on the business card and see the business entity. They didn't detail the name in the lease the way that I would if I had drafted it for them. But as is often the case with leases of this magnitude, they didn't involve an attorney. It would have cost 2 months' rent to get a lease written by my office. Probably it wouldn't be worth it. But more important, I think, in this whole issue of who the lessee was, the facts as found below don't give an impression that there was a difference of opinion between the parties at the time of the lease as to who the party was. This isn't a situation where we can think that Christian Gadbois had a very clear sense in his head that it was this sole proprietorship, and my client thought that it was the LLC and it was an ambiguity. I don't think that you can deduce that from the facts of this record. I think it's very clear, based on his bankruptcy filings, repeatedly signed under penalty of perjury, that he regarded that lease as an LLC lease and those assets as LLC assets until such time as it became inconvenient to him, at which point he altered his papers and filed this adversary proceeding against my client. So if the panel wants to focus on one thing that I think would resolve this whole case, it's this question of estoppel. This case is primarily about the integrity of the judicial process. The question is, can you repeatedly affirm under penalty of perjury that certain assets and liabilities are not yours, and then turn around and claim that they were, when it would give you a cause of action against somebody else and maybe get a little money out of it? Now, another thing that I think needs to be discussed is the standard of review question. And I'm not familiar with this In Re Partida case. I don't think I heard that case until this morning. But I think we need to focus on the factual questions. And there's two that come to mind here. One, this question of the property in the estate, the records and such. I don't think I've heard this statute referenced before. I don't think I saw it in the papers, but I could be wrong. That the records are presumed to be property of the lessee. Well, that argument begs the question. The whole question is, who's the lessee? Because the court below found, based on plentiful evidence, that the lessee was the LLC, those records are presumed to be property of the LLC, and that's not part of the bankruptcy estate.
You know, it might be more appropriate to say the court concluded, in the context of a directed verdict, that the plaintiff here hadn't met its burden of establishing that the individual was the lessee. Would that be fair?
That's correct, John. That's a much more precise way to put it.
Okay.
Now, on the subject of the court's findings, though, and I'd like to end with this and then leave time for you to ask questions if you have them. Judge Cerzoldo did find who the lessee was. We heard from Mr. Chechia just now, that's a question of fact. I think he's right about that. And he did so partially on the basis of Mr. Gadbois' lack of credibility. And there was a prior judgment for a crime involving fraudulent conduct that was admitted However, if you will read Judge Serzolo's decision carefully, he's very clear that he didn't need that particular piece of evidence to make that finding. In fact, if all that we had in this record was the complete 180-degree change of tune in the amended bankruptcy paper, that would be sufficient to establish a lack of credibility. But if the court wants to review the record, I would suggest that you will not find any fact in this record that supports the premise that Mr. Gadbois does have credibility as a witness. So if you're looking for clear error as opposed to substantial evidence, I think it's very clear what you will find. Judge Serzolo heard the evidence. He had a witness with no credibility who had made previous misstatements by his own admission to the court under oath, basically saying that he had a secret understanding of a lease that he had signed that he didn't make known to the other party, and that all of the circumstances indicate would have been an unreasonable reason for the party. And on that basis, he should be able to bring this action against the airport. So I think those are really the key issues in this case. I'm happy to answer any questions the panel has.
No questions. Okay, thank you very much. We have no questions. So the matter is submitted, and you'll get our decision in due course. Thank you for your arguments.
Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate your time. Have a good day.
Thank you, Chief.